KPCW News Time now, 8:06. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. We've got 46 degrees here on this Thursday morning, September 22nd, and on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Nate Larson. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Nate actually couldn't make it today. This is Bob Bedore, and I'll be taking you through your week. And well, you're going to love me once I get past today, because today we're looking at about a 50% chance of showers, going to be some thunderstorms likely, going to be some wind coming in, about 15 to 20 mile an hour wind. So today could be kind of a rough day. It might blow through, but that's what the 50% means. We're looking at a good potential of that coming through. It's just holdovers from yesterday when we had a lot throughout most of our state here in Utah. But after that, things are to clear up. By the time we get into the nighttime, Park City, you're going to be looking at a low of around 39. Those winds are going to die down, but things are going to clear out. And then what we're going to see is a progression of better and better days as we get going. Friday, going to get sunny skies with that wind dying down and a high near 65. So it's going to feel very fall-like since today is the first day of fall. Clearing, staying clear throughout, well, this whole next coming week, as we're going to see a low of around 41 as we get into Friday night. Then again, we're going to see those temperatures just rising. Saturday, a high near 71 degrees with that low at 42. And then you'll see this going through Sunday, high near 72, low at 44. Temperatures rising some more. Monday, that high raising up a little bit more, 74 with a low around 45. Tuesday, raising up still 75 for a high, 47 for our low Tuesday night. Wednesday, though, things will calm down a little bit. Temperatures will drop to low 70s on Wednesday because we do have another storm system starting to come in, but that won't really start to hit us till maybe Thursday. So these next 6 days after we get past today, going to be a beautiful, beautiful day. And you're going to see temperatures just rising. You should see sunny and clear skies throughout. But today, again, thunderstorms possible. So please keep an eye to the sky. And if you hear thunder, get inside, because the last little bits of the storm we had throughout our state yesterday are making their way out. Then you got clear sailing for the rest of the week. Leslie?
Okay, sounds great, Bob. Thanks. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with North Summit Unite organizers Anita Lewis and Lynn Wood with details on Saturday's first ever regional roundup. Then Park City Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieters, along with Kate Napier Jans with Alpine Forestry, they're looking for residents to fill out the community wildfire risk assessment and ask questions. And finally, St. Mary's Volunteer Food Bank Coordinator Sarah Dellenbach discussing the many charitable causes that the church provides to our community. Well, at Tuesday's Park City School Board meeting, a crowd of parents and teachers commented on a new state policy that would establish a process for banning books in the classroom. KPCW's Carolyn Murray reports.
Tuesday's meeting was standing room only. A half dozen people gave public comments opposing the policy that would allow parents to use a process to eliminate books and materials from school curriculums. Park City School District Policy 9051 outlines the path parents, teachers, or students could take to challenge the district's use of sensitive materials as defined by HB 374, a law that took effect in May. Under HB 374, the legislature defines sensitive teaching materials and prohibits using them in Utah's public schools. It requires the State Board of Education to provide training to school districts on identifying sensitive materials. HB 374 now requires parent complaints made to school districts to be reported to the Legislative Committee Overseeing Education and to the Government Operations Interim Committee. Everyone who spoke during Tuesday's public input was opposed to the school board adopting Policy 9051. Park City High School teacher Melissa Nicolai said the stories worth reading are ones with broad characters who struggle with life's indignations, outrage, and judgments. She said students reflect on their own place in the world through the characters' struggles and failures.
To have these discussions is one of the greatest pleasures of being their teacher. This is the purpose of great literature, to develop more empathetic human beings. For what are we as a society if we have no empathy for each other? You shortchange your students' potential as a fully complex human when you limit their ability to read great books together.
Nicolai said she will always respond to parents' concerns.
If books scare you, if you don't want your students exposed to reflection and deeper thinking, then I can and will always offer an alternative. Is it fair, though, to insist that the book is banned for every student?
Parent Kathy Lanigan asked the board to trust the teacher's judgment in selecting learning materials. She said literature used in teaching should represent the broadest possible perspectives of characters and social ideas.
We've all heard the argument that teachers should just stick to teaching the classic. Huckleberry Finn, The Grapes of Wrath, Ulysses, Catcher in the Rye, all of which have been challenged. So which classics will meet every parent's approval? I humbly submit that unless you are discussing Dick and Jane, you will make someone uncomfortable. Lastly, it goes without saying that every parent has the right to question, investigate, and filter what their own children have access to. That right does not extend to other people's children.
Student Zoe Otto told the board the books they read and discuss are essential for students preparing for the world after high school.
I just wanted to say that books have changed my life. I think all of us have a book that has like really opened our eyes that no movie or show or whatever could, you know, change how we look at the world. And I think for us to decide to ban books is really heartbreaking because we need to have controversy and be exposed to that. And we have to have mature discussions about things.
After hearing the public speak out against adopting a policy that could result in banning books, the board held an open discussion about alternatives to adopting Policy 9051. After a closed session with Attorney Mark Moffitt, the board voted unanimously to send 9051 back to the district's policy committee. Board President Aaron Grady issued a statement that said that the changes to the existing policy, 9050, adopted earlier in the meeting, provides parents with processes to challenge sensitive materials used in schools. She said that based on the input from the public, they've decided to review the verbiage and constitutionality of Policy 9051. There were no public comments made supporting the adoption of Policy 9051. The school district must adopt a policy complying with HB 374 by October 1st. The board will meet in special session on Friday at 8:30 a.m. at the district office on Kearns Boulevard. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, North Summit Unite is hosting the first ever North Summit Regional Roundup. It's happening on Saturday, and in the studio with details, I have the president of North Summit Unite, Anita Lewis, and she's joined by Treasurer Lynn Wood. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Maybe, Anita, you can start us off by just telling us what is North Summit Unite.
North Summit Unite is an organization that is hopefully going to promote arts and culture in the community. We have a lot of talent in the North Summit region, and when I say region, it's the North Summit School District. And we would just like to really enhance what we already have and start telling our story. As the North Summit area is under the pressure of new growth, we feel that it's important to talk about what's important to us, preserve our heritage, really identify who we are and what we represent, and just celebrate through different activities and promotional events.
Yeah, so how long has North Summit Unite been around, Lynn?
Well, we're fairly new. We've been a nonprofit for not even a year, so we're just getting our feet under ourselves.
Okay, so it is a nonprofit 501c3 then,
absolutely,
huh?
We did receive that back in February.
All right, membership base, I mean, who's part of this?
Well, we have a 6-member board, but as we've been putting together this new event, we have had scores of volunteers come, and that's probably been one of the most satisfying and rewarding pieces of putting this event together, is just seeing community members coming together and wanting to be involved.
All right. So this is really kind of the first event you guys have produced then as the organization?
Well, we did have one event earlier in the spring, and I think Anita can speak a little bit more about our book signing that we had.
Yes, we had Pete Pasquale, who talked about the Pasquale Ranch. It's in more the Upton area, and he wrote about the ranch and his experience living there, and again, that's what we want to do, is start telling folks who we are, and so people understand us a little bit better.
All right, so did you get a good turnout for
we
that?
We did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We did.
All right, so maybe just tell us what's happening on Saturday.
Well, so much is going on. This all started out with a conversation I had with a member of our community that raises draft horses, and he said, wouldn't it be cool if we could do some wagon rides? And we talked about doing a walking tour of the Colville area, but that really upped the level of this event. And so that was really, that conversation really kicked this off. And it's just grown from there. We've got 9 different stops that these wagons will be at, all kinds of events going on at these 9 different stops.
So why these 9 different stops? What, tell us about where they are.
Well, they have something very special historically or something interesting. At the Ledges Building, we will be having a student art display. And that was an idea that came from one of our volunteers. And they will be explaining through their art what they love about living in the North Summit area. So that will be the first stop. There's a lot of them.
Well, I'd like to add, so working at the courthouse for 30 years, you know, it was always the mysterious Ike Potter story that people talked about, and, you know, he's haunting, you know, the courthouse. And so there's been some mysterious stories that's been told about Ike Potter. So we've had an individual in the area, Lynn Curtis, who's been doing a lot of research, and he's actually going to, we're going to present through some actors the Ike Potter story, and we're going to have citizens be the jury and have them say, is he a hero or is he a villain?
Okay, so Ike Potter was arrested for something? Is that what happened?
Yeah, he's a real person from the area, and he put a curse on Colville. Yes, he or someone else put a curse on Colville that Colville would never prosper, and yeah, his bones were in the Summit County Jail for a long time, or the Summit County Courthouse, and yeah, it's a real deal. So we're excited to portray his story and talk about it a little more.
Okay. And then you're also going to be like visiting the Colville Library, the Senior Center, the fire station, and then looks like the furthest away is the Ledges Trail. And so the horses are going to do all of this?
Well, the horses will be taking people around to each of these different stops. They can stay on or get off at whatever interests them. But the Ledges Trailhead, I'm very excited about that because, as you know, there are hieroglyphs on that ledge right there. It's a very sacred and special place to the Native Americans. And we actually have some performers coming who are descendants of the original tribe that was settled there in Colville. So it's incredibly special. They'll be performing dances. They'll be telling us about the symbolism of the rose that represents their tribe. And it's just important as we embrace the Braves mascot for our North Summit High School, for them to come and explain the symbolism behind some of the things we do.
Right. So how does this all going to work then? I mean, people, if they're driving from the western side of the county, where would they park? And
well, there will be signs directing them in. Look for those event parking signs. You can park at the Ledges Event Center. You can also park at the high school or at the church that's there on Main Street. And then you just jump on at any stop. That's something we really want to get out there.
We have these maps, Leslie, that we will have people passing out. And so they can see where the different events are located and what will be happening at the events. You mentioned the library. Well, the library is in the Summit County, you know, it was the Summit County Hospital, so we're going to talk about that. The senior building was the Echo Depot that came from Echo. So all of these spas, they have a story that we're going to be talking about. But what's most important is to obtain, which we'll have people walking around handing out, this map.
All right. They seem pretty close enough that, I mean, people could do a walking tour if they wanted.
Either way, right. Yeah. If those wagons get too backed up, that's definitely walkable, about a 1.5 mile route. But join in at any one of those stops. You don't have to start at number one.
Okay. And it's free. People just show up and jump on.
It is free.
Yes. Yeah. What else are you going to have going on?
Well, one thing I'm very excited about is the Boyden Block Building, which is a beautiful old building on Main Street. It's been vacant for many years, and it's got one of those old-fashioned soda fountains in there. Well, we got talking with the building owner, who is 88 years old now, and he is a Boyden, a member of the original family that owned the building. He's actually coming here from California to be a part of this event and take place. So we're very excited to welcome the Boydens and have an event there in the building that's been vacant for a long time.
Wow. What's going to happen to the building? Do we know?
Well, they're going to have a table present, and they want people to talk about what they would like to see happen in the building. And I've already heard some ideas that people have come up with that they think would be a good use. So we'd like to see it used. It, you know, I remember when it was a drugstore, and I remember going in there and getting prescriptions and buying sodas. So it's really an icon in the Colville area.
Yeah. Building has good bones, though. It's not like it needs to come down or anything.
Oh, no. It's a great structure. They've restored it. And, yeah, I mean, it's really user-friendly. Open the door today.
Okay. You're also going to have food trucks available?
Well, we did, but some of those have had to withdraw because of other commitments. But we do have several local restaurants will be available. We're going to have a mariachi band, which we're very excited to include our Hispanic community. And that's what is so important. We want one celebration that's inclusive of everyone. And of course, that will be held at the Pocket Park, which is right next to Nina's Market. And they will be selling inside street tacos and different things.
Of course, Denise's.
And Denise's, open. Of course,
it's worth
yes.
the drive, yes.
yes.
Okay. Now, the funding to do all of this came from a Summit County wrap tax. I mean, what was it that you guys applied for? I mean, what was the proposal? Just to have a community gathering like this?
Yes. We received our first grant from the wrap tax, which we're very pleased that we received this grant, very helpful. We wanted to find out what the community wants. What is it they feel that we should do? And so what was most important was we want to celebrate our own stories. We want to keep it local. We want our own talent to be available. So that's why we're really responding to what the citizens said is, let's start celebrating what's already here and let's just enhance it. So we've received two grants from Wrap Tax, and that's really what's helping us do this.
All right. So what are some of the other objectives then of North Summit Unite? I mean, what else have you got in the works?
Well, our motto is really linking our past to our future. And so one facet of this event will be to, yes, celebrate our history and let's learn about it. But where do we go from here? How do we bring that into our future so that we keep our community unique and special like it is right now?
Well, and youth theater was one of the top number one votes that came back as each year the high school and middle school, they've been presenting musicals. And last year, I believe there were over 120 students that tried out and they had to cut it back to 80. So there's a real desire for the youth to become involved and become active in theater. And that is a big goal, is to start enhancing and making that happen.
Yeah. Only the schools have a theater then for
yes.
them to perform in? I mean,
yes.
could they do something at the Ledges or?
Well, we think so. There are other buildings in the area that could, when you travel to different areas, you see things where, these older buildings, they have remodeled mm-hmm. them and turned them into theaters. And so, let's make the dream possible. Let's do it.
Interesting. So you have done some surveys then, huh?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Great. What else did the surveys tell you?
Youth is number one, enhancing what we already have. They also, the parks, they would like to see more music and art in the parks. Canifer has a great stage in their park that could be used, and right now they're just sitting dormant, and it's let's make them of use and celebrate the talent that we have.
Well, they need ladies like you to shake it up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so it's Saturday. When does it start?
Right at noon.
Okay. And you're going to be running their wagons through till when?
Till 4:00.
Okay. All right. Anything else people want to know?
Well, back to Ike Potter. Mm-hmm. So that story will be told at 1, 2, and 3. It's going to be told on the hour, so mm-hmm. it'll be at the Summit County Courthouse upstairs, but that's something that will not be all day at specific times if people are interested in attending that. But everyone's invited and welcome, and we just hope to have a fun day.
Okay.
Right. It applies to all areas of Summit County, and especially your listeners here in Park City. Yeah. We'd love to have you come join us.
Okay. Lynn and Anita, thanks so much for coming in.
Okay. Thank you.
It's Lynn Wood and Anita Lewis again with the organization North Summit Unite, the first ever North Summit Regional Roundup happening this Saturday in Colville from noon to 4 p.m. Well, among the handful of surveys on the engageparkcity.org website, one is about community wildfire risk assessment. And if you'd like to give input, now's the time to do it. In the studio to tell us why it's important that you do so, I have Park City Municipal Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieters, along with Kate Napier-Jans. She works with Alpine Forestry, the company that was in charge of some of the efforts to do the forest thinning and assessment there on the Treasure Hill Open Space. So good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you.
Yeah. So Heinrich, maybe start by telling us about the survey and why you need some feedback here.
Okay, great. So I'll hit right off on where you can find the survey. So that is on the Park City, engageparkcity.org page, and you can look, there's a community wildlife, wildfire risk assessment tab to that. So click on that and you can find it there on the right-hand side where the survey is. And so as the listeners may recall, we kicked off this community wildfire risk assessment numerous months ago. And the purpose of that is to basically provide the community with a plan of how we prioritize work, how we can try to acquire grants, and how we can identify resources associated with our community specifically. And I think Kate can probably speak a little bit to sort of the values that we've seen through. But the importance of the survey in itself is we've held two open houses so far, and we've had a pretty paltry attendance. So we've probably had about 15 people in total. And so this survey is really important because this is our outreach to where we really want to hear from the community. And why is that important, you ask? Well, one goal out of this plan is to actually acquire federal grants. And the grants themselves have components in scoring, and a lot of that has to do with public outreach and engagement. And so we're not going to score very highly if we have 14 people that we've reached through our open houses. So it's very, very important that we get the community to weigh in on some of that. And the reason why, then again, it's important for the community is these grant funds, two part. One, it will help with a possible financial assistance program. So if we are able to acquire those grants, working with HOAs, we can work on a matching grant project or something like that, because these projects in themselves are pretty expensive. The work that we did up on Treasure was about $3,500 an acre. So that's really important. And then if you're sitting at home or in your car and you're thinking, well, why else should I think about this? One of the other aspects that have come through this plan is property or fire insurance coverage. So, you know, we are working on, or through this plan, a possible program where we boost sort of the assessments that we can provide and work with insurance companies to help them understand almost like preventative work, just like in your healthcare, right? You go and get a checkup, if you will, every year. Well, if an insurance company sees that, you know, you're going through a program and the proper authorities or professionals are saying, yeah, you've done this preventative work, it can help with your insurance coverage. So those are sort of some real takeaways for the individual that is sitting there thinking about it, and then the process of grants and financial assistance. And, you know, I think Kate can probably talk about how the plan itself is really specific to our community.
Yeah. Before we get there, though, I mean, the questions of this, I mean, what is it that the survey wants to know?
So a lot has to do with, like, how much, well, what work they actually do or what they provide, how much they're willing to spend on certain things for home hardening or defensible space, what concerns they might have or issues they have with insurance, how they get information, et cetera. So it's very targeted for where we think the plan is going. And again, if we don't hear from the community, it's hard for us, like, you know, there's a component on ordinances, right? So wildfire issues are very similar to noxious weeds. I run that program for the city. You know, I don't know how many times I hear a landowner say, well, I've done my part, right? But the person right next to me hasn't done anything, and the seeds just blow. Well, the wildfire would blow through a community like that as well. So it really has to be a holistic approach to these things. And a lot of times that is best served by an ordinance or some sort of WUI regulation that's provided by the city, in my opinion.
Yeah, so do we have a plan? I mean, is that an approved plan that we're just kind of moving forward with, or this is like the final steps of a plan?
You want to take that one, Kate?
Sure, I'll go ahead and take that. So this plan was originally designed to carry over a year of assessing the community and the values at risk in this community. During phase one, we did basically just some ground truthing. We had the team out here checking out the town and some of the values at risk on the ground. So just a lot of data collection. And then during that phase, we also kicked off, as Heinrich mentioned, the public meetings and also the stakeholder meetings. And so those helped guide some of our initial data collection processes. We are currently in phase two, which is where we are assessing what we're getting out of phase one. But now, what's really important is that we haven't heard, as Heinrich mentioned, we had a very low turnout for these public meetings. And that is, I cannot state the importance of public voices in this kind of risk assessment. As he mentioned, the financial aid assistance and also future actions that may occur, that is driven by the community. And I mean, Park City Municipal Corporation, they're going to do the best they can with the information they have, but future actions really depend on what the community has to offer as far as their wildfire concerns and some of the perhaps the knowledge gaps they have, even in fuel mitigation projects, or as he mentioned, financial assistance for steps they can take to prevent a negative outcome in their communities, their neighborhoods, or their home in the event of a wildfire. So during phase two, we are really stressing the importance of the community survey. And this is where everybody has access to provide their input. And we cannot stress more, this is for you. If we could talk to every single Park City resident directly, I would say, this is for you, this is your project. Your voice matters. Please tell the city what you know, what you don't know, and that way we can pave the future for preventing a negative outcome from wildfire here in Park City. The other thing I really want to stress is that other communities similar to this one have undertaken similar risk assessments. And it is the community members that give those risk assessments a very specific, unique nature. And so if we don't hear from the public, then the fear is that this risk assessment could turn out to be sort of generic, something that doesn't really identify and assess the true values at risk in this community. For example, the historic structures here, the mecca of recreation opportunities. If there was a severe wildfire, what could be lost? What kind of values and what part of the Park City identity could be lost? And that is where the community at large can really provide this critical input.
So, I mean, based on the assessment that you've done so far, right, as part of the work first phase you've done, I mean, what is Park City's risk? Are we at risk?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, for sure. So during phase one, the team did some fire and fuel behavior modeling. Park City does not have an extensive fire history. In some ways, that's good, right? We don't want fire in our towns. Affecting the forests around us, but at the same time, we have to rely on modeling to determine what could be the risk. And currently, with the wildlands surrounding the city, terrain, the forest health conditions, and the lack of fire, because we have done an excellent job of fire suppression over the years, we do have forests and these wildland vegetation types that are in a condition to burn. And so initial fuel and fire behavior modeling does show a pretty high risk in many areas.
Hmm. So when we talk about forest health, and I know that you've specifically worked on just the Treasure Hill open space at this point, I think there's contracts to do something up Daly and Ontario Canyon as well. But tell us what you found there. I mean, how healthy is our Old Town Forest?
That's a great question. So first I'm going to touch a little bit on the past. Again, heavy mining way back in about 100 years ago, and then with that came logging, highly intensive extraction of trees off the ground. And then what happened was the forest converted from this historic kind of larger tree structure with multiple species. And now we're seeing, specifically on Treasure Hill, we're seeing a conifer forest that is dominated by one species, white fir. And what that does is it actually sets the stage for insect infestations. Some of you may have recalled, a lot of you who are intimate with the area may have seen a lot of dead trees across the hill slopes, primarily in the white fir that was caused by a native beetle. And it did result in approximately 30% of stems of the tree stems on Treasure Hill as dying out. And so what happens is when you have this one tree that's susceptible, you could lose a whole stand of trees to that one insect. So what we are trying to do here is not only reduce the ladder fuels and the ground fuels for fire mitigation, but we are also trying to create a healthier stand structure by hopefully reintroducing other native species such as Douglas fir, and trying over time to kind of correct some of these past intensive management.
Yeah, so why is it that the white fir just kind of came up? I mean, a second growth there.
Yeah, typically that is because Douglas fir was a more desired species. It's better for constructing homes and the like. And so a lot of times the white fir was left unplaced and it was a future seed source.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So they took the Douglas fir as their preferred building materials or mine timbers or whatever.
Precisely.
Okay. All right, so we often hear about the pine beetle. That's not the problem we have on the Treasure Hill side because we have just fir.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. It's a similar type of disturbance. It's an insect that bores into the tree and it can result in either just tree damage. Some trees don't die from it. But under stress, such as drought conditions or high tree tree densities where trees are competing for water and nutrients, these types of native insects can have more of an epidemic result rather than just little groups here and there as they did naturally under what we call a normal disturbance regime of the past.
Yeah. So looking at the few comments that you can see on Engage Park City, one person is concerned that thinning forest is not the right thing to do. She says that she cited published reports that fires can actually spread slower through uncut forest because there are higher levels of moisture and nutrients in the soil. Can you address that?
Yes. The thing about thinning forest is that there is still a lot of research that shows it is effective in preventing fire suppression, as well as it can help in the event of even mitigating the severity of fire. So there is a lot of research on the topic, and there is also, I want to stress, there is also a time and a place where you may not want to thin a forest, but directly around town, the one thing that we need to consider is fire mitigation. And so thinning practices have shown, as long as we do the appropriate fuels mitigation practices following thinning, meaning piling and removing slash, then you can remove some of those heavy down fuels.
So there's basically just less fuel to burn in that case.
Exactly.
Okay. So what else do you want people to know in terms of just getting on and filling out the survey, asking questions, making comments?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'll the conversation you just had with Kate, and I think it's important for the listeners to understand that Kate is a forester, that we have a lot of people on staff and with the consultants that are wildlife biologists from Summit Land Conservancy. So, you know, this is a very technical evaluation of our forest as well. But what you just heard was that, this is very specific. It's not a generic plan. You know, again, we're asking the community, you know, one that comes up is, you know, we have historic structures, not just in town, but also throughout our hillsides. You're not going to get, you know, that is not going to be captured in sort of a statewide analysis of your community. Some of our watersheds and streams, some of our sort of threatened species. And so that's what's important. And then the other aspect that's important is really the grant aspect, because without public engagement, the scoring for these federal grants, we will score very low on that. And, you know, again, I don't mean to aid, you know, soup to nuts. We're going to go through this process. We are already applying for several federal grants. If we get those grants, that's financial assistance for people in our community. And we have really reached out, you know, Vail and Deer Valley, the other major, major landowners in this, very important that they're included, and they are. The other part is homeowners associations. We've been targeting them associated with this. But it really boils down to the individual.
Yeah, so would these grants also been then used for ways to reintroduce new species on the hillsides?
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer that. It will go all the way from programming assistance. It could be staff to help people, like if you need an assessment right now, more people to go out and help people, a timely turnaround if their insurance is coming back, that we can help review on that. Money for home hardening, right? Just on your home yourself, defensible space around your structure, as well as fuels mitigation on the hillside. So, I mean, we are, I have never written so much in federal grants, Leslie, I gotta tell you. And it is a world in its own, you know, to learn how to do that. And what you realize is it's very important to hear from the community.
Yeah, what kind of money are we talking about? I mean,
so we are looking at right now, we haven't finished one. One is due, it's a state grant, Community Wildfire Defense Grant. Is that, did I get that right, Kate?
That's correct.
So I think we're shooting for about a $2 million grant associated with that. What I can say on that one at the moment is we feel like the work that we've done, some of the work partnering with Deer Valley and Vail, the work they've done, that will, that is the match. It's not money out of pocket. It's what we've done in 2022 that we'll use for that match. And then Jess Kirby, who is a wonderful employee for Summit County. I just can't say enough about Jess. She's really spearheading with the city a BRIC grant, a federal BRIC grant that we're looking at. Dollar amount, I'm not sure of at the moment, but we're trying to work through that process. So, you know, there's a lot of money that is coming down to the federal government for specifically this work, and we want to be in line, first in line if we can, to get those dollars, and I think that we're well situated to do so.
Okay, people just need to go to engageparkcity.org and just scroll down until they see the community wildlife risk assessment.
See, you said wildlife too, wildfire. I mess it up all the time as well, so yes, please do so.
Okay, Kate Heinrich, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
Well, the Park City Food Pantry at the Christian Center in Park City and Heber, pretty well publicized. That's not the case with the food pantry at St. Mary's Catholic Church. In the studio, tell us a little bit more about that, as well as the other charitable service that the church provides our community, is Sarah Dallenbach. She is the volunteer food bank coordinator for St. Mary's. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. So nice to meet you.
Yeah. So I've heard that the St. Mary's Food Bank has plenty of food for those who need it. At the same time, there are reports out even today about the Utah Food Bank struggling to keep up with the needs. So what's the situation that you see at St. Mary's?
So we do have plenty of food. We service 15 to 30 families each week. It varies each week. Our families have very specific needs generally. We get a lot of our food both from donations and then through parishioners who donate, and then also grocery shopping by our volunteers.
All right, so where is the pantry?
The food bank, the St. Mary's Food Bank, is located up at the Old Town Chapel near the top of Main Street. It's, our address is 121 Park Avenue. The parking is behind the church, and then you go down the stairs to the food bank.
Okay, and so when is it open?
We are open on Tuesdays from 12 to 4, and our customers can come each week if they need to, and we're open to anyone in need.
All right. Do they need to live within Summit County, Wasatch County?
Or? No. Okay. Not at this point in time. When COVID hit, obviously our numbers increased, and at that point we allowed our customers to come every single week with the needs increasing. So, and there was, we do not require that they live in Summit County.
Okay. And I mean, you say that some can come every week if that's the need, or do you ask that they wait every couple of weeks?
No, we at this point in time, with the current economic situation going on, we are open every week for our customers to come each week.
Okay. So what would you have available there?
So we are, first and foremost, we are non-perishables only, unlike the Christian Center. And our staples at the St. Mary's Food Bank are oil, masa flour, rice, dried beans, cereal, pasta and sauce, ramen, mac and cheese, tuna, canned fruit, and corn, canned corn. So those are our basic needs. We obviously accept other donations, are happy to accept other donations. But for the most part, those are what each of our customers take each week.
All right. So you mentioned that it you supply that with either individual donations or those from your parishioners. Do the grocery stores at all help you at all?
Not at this point in time.
Yeah.
Not at this point in time.
Do you actually have to go out and purchase any of those staples then?
Oh, yes. Each week I'm doing a large grocery shopping for the food bank.
All right. And that's with the financial contributions
yes,
that come in.
Yes. Yes. The very generous contributions from our parishioners.
Ah, okay. And then in terms of if somebody did have food they wanted to donate, did he just bring it by then on Tuesdays?
Yes. So we have a couple options. If you'd like to donate food, which we would really greatly appreciate, you can drop the food donations off at the St. Mary's Church on White Pine Canyon off of 224. There's a box inside the doorway at St. Mary's that is designated for food bank. And then also, you are welcome to drop off food donations during the hours that we are open to customers on Tuesdays from 12 to 4.
Okay. There is also the St. Lawrence Thrift Store in Heber City that it's operated by the parishioners. I mean, so you do take lots of donations here in Park City to make that happen, huh?
We do. So the thrift store is in Heber, as you mentioned. Our drop-off here in Park City is up at the Old Town Chapel in the parking lot there. So you can drop off donations. And then there's also a truck that if you have furniture that needs to be picked up, there's a St. Lawrence Thrift Store truck that can come to your home or office and pick up furniture as well. So, and right now they are, I believe they are accepting furniture at the St. Lawrence Thrift Store. I know for a period of time they were full. So, and the other thing that they are greatly in need of right now at the St. Lawrence Thrift Store is skis and snowboards, because we have our upcoming ski and snowboard sale. So if you have extra skis and snowboards, I encourage you to donate them to the St. Lawrence Thrift Store.
Okay, when is that sale happening?
That sale is in mid-November at the Zermatt Resort.
Ah, okay.
In Midway.
All right. We'll probably run a public service announcement on that and let people know about that.
Super.
So if you do have some furniture that you would like picked up, how does that work?
So you would call, and all of this information that we're speaking about can also be found on the St. Mary's website, which is stmarysparkcity.com. And then to find these ministries that we're speaking about, you go to the Get Involved tab. And the hours for the St. Lawrence Thrift Store and the drop-off will be on that webpage.
Okay. What items would you prefer people not drop off?
You know, you can probably, I would direct you to that webpage to find out the items that they are most in need of and items that they don't need at this point in time. I would say, please make sure that your items are in decent condition. And the other point I would like to make is do not leave if the drop-off is locked, if they're not open, please do not leave them outside because they get thrown in the trash because they've gotten wet or frozen in our climate or something. So
when are they there? Do you know? It would be on the website.
It's on the website. Yep.
Okay. All right. What other services does the church offer?
So another great service that the that St. Mary's provides, our ministry is called the Gabriel Project, and this is a ministry that guides and supports young women as they make the brave decision to choose life. So they help support these young mothers through, you know, help with diapers and clothing and perhaps bigger items like car seats or things like that, and just the love and support that these young mothers might need going through this difficult time.
Okay.
And that there's information for that under our ministry tab as well on the website.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention?
Volunteers for St. Mary's, for these various ministries that we've spoken about, we can always use volunteers, and information for that is found on the website under this Get Involved tab. We can always use food bank volunteers. You do not have to be a St. Mary's parishioner to volunteer, and our volunteer shifts are on Tuesdays, and they're 2-hour shifts. So if you would like more information on that, please see the website. And food donations are greatly appreciated as well.
Okay, Sarah, thanks for your time.
Thank you,
morning.
Leslie. Take care.
Sarah Dellenbach again with St. Mary's Catholic Church. Again, you can find out more by going on to the website, stmarysparkcity.com. Well, Bryn Carey started the rental and delivery service Ski Butlers back in 2004 on Daly Avenue in Park City. The company, which now operates at 50 areas worldwide, was acquired by Alterra Mountain Company earlier this month. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more about that.
Ski Butler's CEO, Bryn Carey, told KPCW that he never planned on selling.
When Alterra approached me over the course of time, it just seemed like it was the perfect timing to do this and become a part of a company where, you know, our vision is to be in every major ski destination in the world. And this allows us to continue that growth and get into more locations and service more customers. So it was a good fit culture-wise, service-wise, and a challenge for someone like myself who's very competitive.
The company is already servicing popular ski areas like Jackson Hole, Steamboat, Whistler, and Sun Valley. Carey plans to expand services to Mammoth Mountain in California this winter. Ski Butlers employs 10 to 15 full-time employees in the off-season. That number grows to over 250 during peak ski season. Carey said he has a lot of traveling to do in the meantime amid the buyout.
One of my favorite part of the jobs is being able to go visit Big Sky or Aspen or Palisades and Tahoe and get to see the community, see their challenges, and get to meet the team members. So we'll continue that, and we'll probably add a little extra time to meet with the folks at the ski resorts as well.
The company has played a role in Mountain Towns 2030 and announced earlier this year that it was becoming climate neutral. Carey said the effects of climate change are apparent in the ski industry.
Thanksgiving has been a little bit more challenging, of course. We don't know how much snow we're going to have. And March is becoming warmer. And so I think the beginning and end of the season, you can feel that shrinking in a little bit on us. So we got to do everything in our power to stop that from happening.
Ski Butlers will remain an independent, standalone company under the Alterra umbrella. Carey said he has no plans to retire and will continue as CEO. He said a lot of work remains to be done.
I think right now I have a big challenge of integrating Ski Butlers into Alterra, and that might be more work for the short term. But I try to have a balance. And maybe there is a little bit less pressure, but I always put pressure on myself. I'm competitive. I like to try to do a really good job, and I like to lead my team to think big and go bigger than they ever thought possible.
Ski Butlers will continue to operate out of its headquarters in Prospector. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And in a public quarterly meeting this evening, Heber City will be revealing future development options that it's considering with the airport. KPCW's Ben Lasseter has more on that.
As part of a master planning process the Heber Valley Airport is undergoing, the meeting Thursday evening will present multiple possible options for the evolution of the airport. The planning began in 2020, then went on a pause during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. City and airport officials say the eventual goal is to upgrade the facilities to accommodate the planes that use it. Airport traffic is controlled by the Federal Aviation Administration, which funds the majority of airport costs. Because of increased traffic, especially among faster planes, the FAA requires the city to upgrade its facilities for that type of aircraft. During a Heber Valley Airport Board meeting earlier this year, consultant Kurt Castagna said the primary focuses are the runway and taxiway. Airport officials have said the master plan could also include changing the hangar layout and adding public attractions. It's happening Thursday at 7 p.m. at Heber Valley Elementary, 730 South, 600 West in Heber City. A city release says city and airport staff will stick around to answer all questions members of the public may have. The Heber Valley Airport in southern Heber City serves exclusively private flyers. It's seen an uptick in regular traffic in recent years and is known for becoming busiest during the early winter months. However, flight data shows its numbers have also increased significantly year-round in recent years. Visit the web version of this report at kpcw.org for more.